no matter how many degrees a person has, no matter how many residencies they've done, you are the expert on you. And remember that. So don't let anybody tell you that you're okay if you feel you're not. Then move on.
Welcome to A Certain Age, a show for women who are unafraid to age out loud. Beauties, I'm a college grad. I have a master's degree. I've had multiple careers, working as a teacher in corporate America and in newsrooms. I've even worked on Capitol Hill, where I helped manage legislative policy for a U.S. senator. So I feel like I know a thing or two, but I still find managing matters like my taxes and healthcare to be overwhelming. I mean, these systems are crazy confusing, complex, and difficult to navigate. Today, I am thrilled to welcome to the show a visionary woman who is going to help us get our healthcare trains on the tracks. Dr. Sharon Malone is a DC-based OBGYN and certified menopause practitioner. She is the chief medical advisor at Alloy Women's Health, a telehealth company that focuses on women over 40. She is on Michelle Obama's speed dial for all things health. And she is the author of the new book, Grown Woman Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy. This book is going to change how you think about managing your health. You are going to want to press this book into the hands of every woman you know. I'm telling you, it's packed with actionable, user-friendly, smart ideas, lots of wisdom. We need to make this book required reading. If you feel overwhelmed by our healthcare system, if you're standing at the intersection of aging and health, anxious and wanting ideas, if you simply want to hang around with a super smart and inspiring woman, stick around. This show is for you. Welcome, Dr. Malone.
Thank you so much, Katie, for having me. That was a great introduction. I'm going to take you on the road with me.
Well, I would be thrilled because I love hearing you talk. I've been dying to get you on A Certain Age ever since I saw you speak at some of the New York menopause events. I heard you a couple of weeks ago in South by Southwest, and I know how, all the smart, actionable info you share. But it wasn't until I read your book that I learned your interesting backstory. You're the youngest of eight, and then you got started in women's healthcare for a very personal reason. As stage setting, I would love it if you could share a little bit of your own story and why you choose to focus on women's health as a career.
Yes, you know, I'm the youngest of eight, and when you're the youngest of eight, you get to see a lot of things, and you get to see a lot of how people age, what their health journeys have been. But I think it really started for me when I was just a little girl, and unfortunately, I lost my mother when I was 12, and I remember thinking at the time, having no medical background, that this wasn't really how it was supposed to be, and not just the course of her illness, which was very brief. She only lived 6 months after she was diagnosed with colon cancer, but just the quality of the interaction that my family and she had with the medical personnel at that point. It left me wanting. And even though I probably was already thinking about being a doctor, I thought about that interaction really changed what kind of doctor I wanted to be. And I never wanted to put a patient or a family in a position where they felt unheard and unseen.
And this notion of being unheard and unseen, I think, is so important. I mean, your book talks about how hard it can be for people to be seen and taken seriously by the healthcare industry. I mean, we talk about people of color, women, people from certain socioeconomic backgrounds, people from rural America are not often given the same kind of access or seen as the same type of patients as other people. Does this play any role in your advocacy? You know, how does it inform the writing in your book?
Absolutely. I think it is really the bedrock of the writing in my book, simply because when I wrote this book, you have to decide when you're, and this is my first and only book. So when I thought about it, I said, well, what kind of book do I want to write? And my guiding principle has always been, well, if you don't have something to say, don't write a book. You know, I mean, books can sometimes be vanity projects.
That's a pretty good starting point, right? You know, have a point of view.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, you write a book because you think you're interesting. And I personally think everybody has a very interesting backstory. But what was important for me is how does my backstory and my experience inform or help someone else? And that's really how I got to this book. And I have been the informal health advisor for most people in my family and a good portion of my friends, simply because I'm the only doctor in the group. And I wanted to take, actually, let me say this. I was surprised by, and I'm talking to very educated women who have access, how little they knew, not just about their health in general, but just the logistics of how to navigate this crazy, unnecessarily complex system that we're all trying to live in. And let me say this, and if you are a woman, and we know from past experience that women's complaints are always minimized, there is always the sort of patriarchal nature of doctor-patient relationships. So you've got that piece, and then you've got the real life experience. What, how do you show up in that world if you're a Black woman, if you're a Hispanic woman, if you are economically disadvantaged? All of these things weigh heavily into what the quality of your experience is going to be with healthcare professionals. And we don't have enough cultural sensitivity. We don't have enough gender sensitivity in these interactions to make it really worthwhile. So I felt that people and women in particular, they needed a little guidebook to tell them, all right, someone's going to say X, but this is what I want you to ask. And that is really where my book comes from.
Your book does that so beautifully. I mean, I think, you know, I said at the beginning of the show, I think it should be required reading. And I truly, truly mean that. I had my own eyes opened about ways that I could be a better advocate for myself, the ways that I can encourage people in my life to be better advocates for themselves. And I love the stage setting that you open with, that given the state of our current healthcare system, you really need to be your own best advocate, right? I think that I at least grew up in thinking like the doctors were in charge, you know, and you very much make the case in the first chapter of your book that the purpose of this book is for readers to become their own best primary caregiver. I went down to write something you say later on the book. You say, quote, in the changing medical landscape, it's every woman for herself. No one is coming to save this, to save us rather. And I mean this in the best possible way. I mean it to motivate you, not discourage you. You must take full charge of your health and your healthcare. And I noted this language down because it really spoke to me. Because just this past weekend alone, I was talking to a friend of mine who said, wait a minute, why wouldn't my doctor have suggested that I go on HRT? She was waiting for the doctor to be in charge. And I hear this again and again. So before we dive into some of your concrete recommendations for getting and staying healthy, which we're definitely going to get to, I would love it if you could share with our listeners why our past, current, and kind of future healthcare systems truly require us to get in the driver's seat.
Well, I'll just give you an example of what my career was like. I practiced medicine for over 30 years before I took a little detour and decided to work in telehealth and write this book. And I could see the changes coming. When I started way back in 1992 in my private practice, I joined a practice that had been in existence for 30 plus years before I got there. Very well established practice. Patients had been there through generations. And I had the luxury of practicing in one place with families that had been with us forever. I watched young women go through high school, college, have children, and go through perimenopause. So there is a great deal of context and relationships that were established. My patients trusted me, not just because I just walked in and look at my degree on the back of the wall. No, they trusted me because they knew me and I knew them. That experience for most people today is no longer going to be, is not a viable option. Doctor, the nature of medical practices has changed. And this sort of self-contained, independent doctor offices that you may have had in the past, those are going away. I mean, more and more and more doctors' practices are being bought up by either hospital groups or venture capital groups that are sort of forming these large conglomerates. And your doctor is now an employee. They are not owners of their practice. And as an employee, you're no longer as loyal to that particular practice because it's not yours. You may move and you'll find that there's a good bit of doctor churn. You'll find that even the way the insurance market is working, you may change jobs, you may move. You can stay with the same insurance and all of a sudden your doctors are being dropped by your insurance carrier. And this puts you in the unfortunate predicament of having to constantly re-explain yourself to a new group of healthcare providers. So the continuity is really compromised. And that's unfortunate because that means that the only constant in this ever-changing environment is going to be you. So that's why I said this is an opportunity, not really just the bad side of it, but an opportunity for you to realize that you are in control of your story, how it's told, how your care is managed in a way that we may have not been in the past, because we did assume that, well, my doctor knows me. He or she will make the best decision for me. No, they don't know you. And that's the message I want to drive home. And if they don't know you, don't expect that they're going to necessarily make good choices for you.
Thank you so much for that explanation. That chapter of the book actually was really riveting to me because you spelled things out that I hadn't considered, that I absolutely, as I was reading your words, realized that that's been my own experience with my care. And it hadn't been crystallized in that way. I think it's a really important chapter for any woman who's listening to the show to truly understand what the current landscape is like and why it's so important to get in action. We're heading into a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about the many chapters in your book that focus on these different key pillars of health and some of your more concrete recommendations for becoming our own primary care doctor and putting ourselves firmly in that driver's seat. We'll be back from the break.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Dr. Malone, we're back from the break. When we went into it, you did some great stage setting. You let us know why it's really incumbent on us to be in the driver's seat of our own healthcare. Your book has chapters on all the key pillars of health, lifestyle choices, cardiac health, brain health, obviously reproductive, peri and menopause. I'd love to touch on as many as we can, but let's start with peri and menopause because in some way, menopause marks an end, the end of reproduction, but it's also a beginning. It is a beginning of a new set of health challenges that impact every aspect of our body. I love what you say in the book. Menopause is like parenting. Once you're in it for life. What do you want every woman who is in this journey to know about taking care of their menopausal health?
What I really want them to know is, first off, what it is. I want them to understand that menopause is way more than just hot flashes. And I think we tend to minimize the symptoms and the suffering that women go through, not just at menopause. And for those listeners who may not know what I'm talking about when I say menopause, there are really two phases of it. There's perimenopause, which is just the menopausal transition, which happens anywhere from 4 to 10 years before you've had your last menstrual period. And then once you've had your last menstrual period, how do you know it's the last one? Well, it's confirmed after 12 months of not having another one. And that's when you are officially menopausal. And the term that I really don't like is to say that then you're postmenopausal, because to say you're postmenopausal means you're over it and you're never over it. The menopausal journey is called the rest of your life. And that's the hormonal state that you will be in forever unless we intervene.
Yes.
And I think that that's the important thing that women need to understand, is that it's not a one and done. Once your hot flashes go away, then okay, I'm done with menopause. No, it has profound impact on your bone health, on your cardiovascular health, and even your sexual function from now on. So understand that it is something that needs to be tended to and paid attention to, not just in that transition period, but forever.
Yeah, absolutely. Menopause is like parenting, right? It absolutely never ends. So for women who are, you know, my listeners tend to be 45 to 65. So they're either sort of approaching menopause, or they're firmly in that postmenopausal state. I know from having other doctors on the show, I know from hearing you speak, that sometimes the symptoms of menopause don't present themselves for decades. You might wake up and realize you've broken a hip because your bone health was compromised. So for women who think they're skating through menopause because they didn't have a lot of hot flashes and they're kind of just done with the whole thing, what do women need to know today to be looking down the road and investing in steps that will protect their longer-term health?
Okay, number one, I would say women have to guard and protect their cardiovascular health. And even though we spend an inordinate amount of time on breast cancer, and we should, it's important, and I think that the impact that we have had probably over the past 30 or 40 years in increasing the cure rate of breast cancer really has to do with awareness, number one, early intervention. Those are probably the bulk of the advances we've made. And then we've made some advances in treatment. But to give you some perspective, we spend, again, a lot of time on breast cancer, not enough time on cardiovascular disease, because this is something that women don't necessarily think about, but cardiovascular disease kills more women each year than all cancers, not just breast cancer, than all cancers combined. And yet, for reasons that are, I think, probably due to just awareness, we're more afraid of breast cancer than we are of having a heart attack or a stroke, or even some of the more debilitating chronic conditions with cardiovascular disease. And so I want women to understand what is the genesis of this cardiovascular sort of epidemic. A lot of it's lifestyle. It's far less genetic than things that we actually do have control over. I want women to understand that these outcomes are not inevitable. And it really starts around the time of perimenopause and menopause. And I'll give you an idea. When you are in perimenopause and premenopause, so women who are in their 40s, usually in 50s, women have about half the risk of heart disease as men. And that's great, wonderful. But what happens after menopause? In the 10 years after menopause, when your estrogen levels are low and your ovaries are no longer producing, then the rate of cardiac disease for women approaches that of men. Within 10 years, you were just about at parity. And unfortunately, not only are we at parity for the incidence of heart disease, but women with heart disease do worse. More women die in the first year after a heart attack than men do. More women have strokes than men do as a result of their cardiovascular disease. So in relatively rapid order, and 10 years is rapid to me these days, we are finding that things that were not as problematic for us when we were younger become problematic for us as we age. And what's the difference? It happens in those 10 years after menopause. So that's why I said I don't want women to think, well, I'm done, right? Okay, we're on to something else. No, this is also the time when osteoporosis becomes an issue. Because for women who are at risk for fractures, and you know who you are, you may not think you know, but it just has to do with the size of your bones. If you're a small bone person, a small frame, you don't weigh a lot. Even if you weigh a lot and you have small bones, that's the key. And I think that's a misperception there that, like, just because you're heavy, you're not at risk for osteoporosis. Not true. It's the size of your bones, not necessarily the size of your body. But that is a very significant risk for women and how we age, and not only just death from hip fractures, but the loss of mobility, the loss of our independence as we age. And again, these are things that can be intervened, and you can intervene early on in this process and turn that train around. You don't have to keep going in that direction. So, you know, if I had to say the two big, big things that I want women to understand, you're not out of the woods. And I use my book to sort of explain what are the basic lifestyle things you can do to actually, you can't stop it forever, but you could certainly minimize your risks.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I think the book does so beautifully. It really provides like an optimistic framework. And everyone wants to have a sense of agency over their own lives. And it feels empowering to know that some of these choices are ours to make, that we can put ourselves into action. We're going to dive into your lifestyle recommendations in just a minute, but I would love to ask you a little bit about the role of HRT in both managing symptoms like, you know, hot flashes, mood swings, that type of thing, and where you believe HRT, what kind of role it plays in some of these bigger lifestyle impacts like cardiac health and bone health. And then we can perhaps hear your recommendations on lifestyle choices as well to follow.
Sure. Hormone replacement therapy or menopausal hormone therapy, you know, we get a new name every other year, it seems. But, you know, I said, I'm old and
we get new names, but not enough research,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
We're just getting rebrands. They're just like repackaging it, but not maybe, you know, it's all sizzle, no steak. We want some steak.
Here's what I want women to know is that hormone therapy for the treatment for the symptoms of menopause is not new. Premarin, which was the first commercially available hormone therapy, was patented in 1942. So there are practically, it's hard to think of another medication that has been around in its original form, because we still have Premarin on the market, for as long as it has. I mean, imagine, we're almost coming up on 80 years now. So we pretty much know the landscape of hormones, and we know it treats the symptoms of menopause. And where we got to, I think where we are now, where we're fearful of hormones, is because of a study that came out 21 years ago that really sort of put in women's minds, not only is it not helping your heart, it's increasing your risk of breast cancer. And that was a double whammy that really came out full force. You know, there was a whole press conference announcing this. And women who had been successfully taking hormones for years and were doing quite well sort of dropped it like it was hot and said, oh my goodness, doctor, you're going to kill me with these hormones. Well, that is the message that we've been trying to undo for the past 20 years, because it turns out we've gone around the world and back again. And guess what? Hormone therapy does decrease the risk of heart disease if it is taken within a certain window. The earlier you take it in your menopause, the more benefit you achieve from it. And by that, I mean, if you take it before age 60 or within 10 years of menopause, and even that, those numbers aren't hard and fast. It just gives you a framework for understanding that the earlier, the better. If you're trying to do a prevention study, which they were trying to do with the Women's Health Initiative, they allowed women to be in the study. You could be anywhere from 50 to 79. Now, I think we can all agree, if you're trying to prevent heart disease, starting it at 79 is probably a little bit too late. And that was the flaw in the study. And it sort of cemented this notion in women's minds for a generation and in doctors' minds that hormones are dangerous. It's going to, you know, oh, but if you must take it, take a little bit for a short period of time, just until you get over these hot flashes. And that mindset has stuck. And I want women to understand this. Number one, there is nothing more effective for the treatment of hot flashes than hormone therapy, not the herbal concoctions, not, you know, whatever the stuff you're getting from your herbalist or your hairdresser, and people are trying all these things because women are suffering and they want someone to help them. And we spend a lot of time and a lot of money on things that are far less effective. So that's that.
Right. And people are taking, I mean, it's interesting that people are relying on things like herbal supplements or things that aren't maybe even third-party tested.
Right.
And they're fearful of something that has a lot of testing and decades of data on it.
Exactly. Exactly. You don't even know what's in it, much less whether or not it's effective. Because when you are in the supplement market, all that they really have to approve, they have to prove when introducing a supplement is they have to, safety. It has to not kill you. It does not have to work. There is no
standard. That feels like a pretty low bar. Well, that's like, maybe that's a high bar. We don't want it to kill us.
Yeah,
but in terms of efficacy, it's a pretty low bar.
But you know how they're going to find out if it's going to kill you? You're going to take it and someone has to report it and say, oh yeah, it did kill you. You know?
Oh dear.
There's no a priori evidence out there that it won't. Because a lot of the supplement market, and it depends on, again, let me qualify this. It depends on the supplement, depends on the source. Some of them have contaminants in them. So there are things, and they don't, a lot of them, when you pull them off the shelf, they don't even have what they say is in them in the amounts that they say they're in. So that'll be what I'll say about the supplement market. But the point of this is that women have been searching. In these 20 years, while hormone therapy was in the doghouse, do you think women stopped suffering? They did not. But they kept looking for other sources. And so I think women have been the victim of a lot of chicanery, a lot of people selling them things that doesn't work. So that was my number one. If you are symptomatic, there's nothing that works better than hormone therapy. That's number one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love how you flag the fact that not every doctor knows this, because
right.
I think, you know, again, going back to the beginning of our conversation where many people, you know, at one point, including me, you know, ironically, I feel like I'm better educated about my health by becoming a podcaster than by walking into a doctor's office for many years. I have learned that I need to be working with a doctor, and I now am, you know, who's a certified menopause specialist, who is a double board certified in both OBGYN, but also integrative health, and really cares about hormonal health and has prioritize this as a practice. But women who are simply relying on their doctor may not be getting the up-to-date science that they need. And you know, you should be looking for certified menopause specialists, which you can find at menopause.org, which is NAMS, the National Association of Menopause Specialists. I'm on the board of Let's Talk Menopause. They also offer resources for women to find doctors in their own areas. And I would love for you a little bit, or maybe even now is the right time. Tell us a little bit about Aloy Health and some of the telehealth options that are available, because not every woman is physically near a doctor who is trained.
We have to deal with the reality in the country right now. And this demographic of women over the age of 50, we are the largest growing demographic. And when we're talking about OBGYNs, they're probably a little bit more than 20,000 in the entire United States. For 55 million women, there are 50% of the counties in this in the United States do not have a practicing OBGYN. And that's horrifying. And given the current political environment, there will probably be even more counties in more states where there are no practicing OBGYNs. So this is where it's important that we have such spotty coverage and we have so few doctors that are trained in menopause, that we have to use a different model. And I think that if there's anything that COVID taught us was that telehealth is a viable alternative for delivering care for certain things. And menopausal care is certainly falls into that category. The main thing about menopause is that it requires, when you have questions, it requires some education on the front end. It requires education once you know what it is, education about your choices. And that's where telehealth really, really comes in. You can do this without having to take a half day off from work, spend lots of money parking and be frustrated and get into a doctor's appointment and where a doctor will tell you, oh, no, dear, that couldn't be menopause, or no, you can't have that. That happens. More than you know, that we have doctors who haven't kept up and they just won't prescribe because they don't think it's a good idea. And these are probably doctors who have come of age in that 20 years after the Women's Health Initiative when it got the black eye. But that is not true. I think that if you can't find a certified menopause practitioner, then telehealth, and particularly, that's why I joined My Alloy, because I realized that there's only so much I can do in the course of a day. And no matter how much I try to explain to women, I only have about 5 minutes really of their 15-minute appointment to try to get everything. And it's just not possible. So that's why I'm a big fan of telehealth, particularly for things like this, where you can spend a lot of time on your own, at your own pace, reading, looking at the options, and then making decisions for yourself. Because I think that this is all about my book, Telehealth, Alloy Women's Health, is about agency. And that's the point I want to make. We want to democratize access, and we want to give you agency, because I don't think that it is a doctor's place to tell you what you can and cannot have. I don't think it is their place to deny you care that you feel you need because of what they think. And, you know, that's all I ask. I say this a lot because my job in my new job in this world is that I want to tell you something. I'm not trying to sell you something, because I feel that my role as medical advisor for Alloy Women's Health is to educate women. I'm not a salesperson. I want you to know what your options are. And my mantra is, I'm trying to tell you something. I'm not trying to sell you something. And I think if you get good information, I am confident that women can make good choices for themselves. So you don't need me to gatekeep. You don't need me to tell you what you can and cannot have. That's your decision. And that's the empowerment model is behind all of it. It's behind my book. I want women to go out there. I want you to know things so you can ask good questions and get good answers. And if doctors put you off or they're annoyed by your questions, then you need to find a new doctor, because that's not a person that is going to serve you well in the long run.
Yeah, that's such great advice. I've had multiple medical providers on the show, including doctors. I think of, Dr. Angelish Kumar, a urologist that I interviewed, who said that women walk through her door after seeing six specialists and suffering for 10 years. Or I think of the founder of Meditrust, who helps women with hair loss. And she said patients are usually on their fifth, sixth, seventh practitioner before they walk through the door. I mean, women have to be persistent to get the healthcare that they need. And your book is a wonderful starting point. Anyone who reads it is going to feel smarter about what they need to be asking for. So I'm thrilled to have you with us now. Let's talk a little bit. I have two things that I want to ask you about before our time ends. I was really fascinated with your chapter on brain health and Alzheimer's in particular. This touches so many people. It's beginning to touch my life. And in that chapter, which was really illuminating, you introduced me to a concept that I never had heard of, which is called weathering, this notion mm-hmm. of sort of accelerated aging. I thought this was fascinating, and I would love it if you could share with our listeners what this concept is and how we might mitigate against it.
Sure. This concept was really popularized by Dr. Arlene Geronimus. I think she's at the University of Michigan. And she talks about what your lived experience is. And this, particularly when she talks about, when you look at communities that are economically disadvantaged, you look at communities of Black people, you look at Native American communities, the harshness of your life, the more things that you have to deal with, the chronic stress that you find yourself in, these are the things that, believe it or not, these are not things that are imprinted in your DNA. However, they do wear you down. It damages your DNA such that this sort of weathering or accelerated aging process. And I think that it's something that, you know, but you needed someone to really explain it to you because everybody knows. I'll give you a good picture. A smoker. If you've seen those pictures where, you know, here's a person who doesn't smoke and here's a person who smokes, right? And you look at their skin, how they look. It's just that, you know, someone who has been smoking two packs of cigarette a day looks different on the outside and they are different on the inside. So all of these environmental things age you. But not only do they age your body, they age your brain. And so we have to really look at marginalized communities, chief among them, African-American communities, and ask the question, why do African-American women have twice the rate of Alzheimer's as white women? Why do women have twice the rate of Alzheimer's as men? And these are observations that, again, are not new. And what is perplexing to me is that we've described it. Why hasn't anyone said, huh, wonder why that is? Let's do some research. And I will give credit to the great Dr. Lisa Moscone, who has just written a book called The Menopause Brain. And she is, believe it or not, one of the few neuroscientists who's done more than just observe what happens and try to come up with places where we can intervene. And it turns out the same things that we need to do to preserve our heart are the same things that we need to do to preserve our brain health. And women share a disproportionate part of this burden of Alzheimer's and cognitive decline, not only because, you know, women have different lived experience, we have different hormonal experiences, and it turns out that women's brains age more than men because of our rapid shift in our hormones at, you guessed it, menopause. So I say this to say all of these things that we've got to take into account, but not to be gloom and doom. These are opportunities because once we know what those things are, then we have the opportunity to come in and intervene and figure out, let's not get there. Because a lot of the bad outcomes in health are not inevitable. They're not inevitable, and they're not really just because of race. When we talk about racial disparities, yeah, they exist. But it's not being Black that's the problem. It's being Black in a system that does not see you, in living in poor environments, in not having access to clean water, clean air, healthy foods. Those are what we call the social determinants of health, which will determine how you age. And when I tell you it's not just race, look at the poor people in Appalachia, the white people, look at them. So we know what those factors are. And I think what's been lacking is research aimed at making interventions.
Absolutely. It's like astonishing when you spell it all out, because it's such a intertwined system. Yeah. Everything impacts where you're being raised, the stress that you're under,
right,
the level of access you have to care, the sort of the corrosive nature of constantly feeling under threat on our health. It makes so much sense. So we need a multi-pronged reaction and response to manage this and shift the needle. For listeners, right, who are thinking, you know, some of those things don't apply to me, but the modern ills of modern life do, the stress and the sort of corrosive nature of that on ourselves, that's one intervention that we can take. What would be others? Because you said that what is good for the brain and good for the heart are the same thing. So
yes,
what can we put in our listeners' hands to say, you know, I want to have access to that. And not only for myself, but maybe I want to figure out a way of bringing this to my community and as part of my civic life. How do I make sure other people have access to these things as well?
You know what? I think if I had to say the lifestyle things that have the most impact on your health generally, and you know them, but you don't do them, you know them.
Tell us, because every time I hear it, I get a little bit more inspired to be better, because we need to, this is like ripping off the prescription pad. Hand us this prescription. You know, we want to be better.
Okay. Number one, don't smoke and limit alcohol intake. And I think this is something that is kind of, people thought, oh, you know, red wine is good for your heart. Well, too much red wine is not good for your health, and alcohol generally. So limit the amount of alcohol you drink. And we say less is more in this case, but certainly less than one drink per day or seven a week. And if you can do less than that, great. And let's not forget, we've got exercise is key to heart health, brain health. And I say exercise, and the current recommendation is 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. I say do as much as you like. More is more in this situation. And the one thing that I keep telling women about exercise is that it's good for your mood, it's good for your heart, it's good for your brain. It is not good for losing weight. So if your only motivation for exercising is that, oh, I want to lose weight, it's not going to work out that great for you. It is the other things you must do. Exercise helps. It certainly helps, but it as a weight loss program, no. So I try to give as many different reasons as I can for why exercise is important. Mood, heart, brain, cardio, and for your bone health as well. So exercise is key. And I think if you are one of those people that you have found yourself in a situation where you're already hypertensive or diabetic, understand that these are things that are also manageable. If you do the first three, do those. And if you're still there, take your medication. This is not something to skimp on, because controlling your blood pressure, controlling your blood sugar are key to maintaining your cardiovascular and your brain health. Just having diabetes alone sort of markedly increases your risk for Alzheimer's and heart disease. So that. And the last that I will say is sleep, the importance of sleep. And we're just sort of getting around to that, because sleep disturbances really come up in midlife, really in perimenopause and menopause. And that's why I would encourage women, if the sleep issues that you are having, particularly if they're due to hot flashes, you should get your hot flashes treated. Because disrupted sleep, night after night, years on end, also is a big risk factor for not only aging your heart, but aging your brain, and just making you feel lousy and unproductive in the course of a day. So if you did those things, if you minded those, that is your best shot. And you'd be surprised, not only would you decrease your heart disease risk, Alzheimer's risk, and what we didn't even talk about, you decrease your cancer risk. Huge.
So important to have these great reminders. And I just rounded up three episodes I did on sleep with two sleep doctors and a sleep coach, which I shared last month when it was March and National Sleep Month. So I'd encourage all listeners to go check those out if you're really struggling. One of the doctors, Dr. Shelby Harris, said, to echo Dr. Malone, like, if you walk into a doctor and they don't take your sleep seriously, find a new doctor, because this is foundational. So thank you for reminding us about that. We are going to be heading into our speed round in just a minute, because our time is nearing an end. But before we do, I want to ask you one last question. You know, you have been doing this work for years, and I know that you have a daughter, and I have one as well. Mine is 23. So for people who are listening who, you know, have young women in their lives that are looking to the future, you know, I would love it, you know, if you feel like whipping out your crystal ball, where do you think we're heading in terms of care? Are we at the tipping point that we need to be? What's going to be the future of our daughter's healthcare and menopause care in this country?
I think that we're starting to see it already, particularly in young women. More of their care is going to be delivered. It's going to be via algorithm. As I said, they're not going to have relationships, long-term relationships with doctors. They may see a different one every time they go in. And this is where, again, that empowerment piece is important, because they have to educate themselves so they know how to interact with doctors. And doctors don't know everything. Let me just say that. A lot of them think they do, but we don't. And I would say that this next generation is not going to be shy about just saying, oh, well, that's what the doctor said. No, I think they're going to be much more proactive in their care, and they should be, because no matter how many degrees a person has, no matter how many residencies they've done, you are the expert on you. And remember that. So don't let anybody tell you that you're okay if you feel you're not. Then move on.
Great advice. Well, I said at the beginning of the show that every woman needs to give this to their girlfriends. It's the perfect hostess present, but it sounds like it's also the perfect gift for your daughter. So put this in their hand. This is for grown women and growing women. So let's get this into young women's hands too, so that they can be in the driver's seat of their healthcare. All right. Well, our time is near an end. We're moving into the speed round. This is just this high energy note to end on. So we can cover a little bit more ground before we have to say goodbye. So it's a one or two word answer. Let's do it. Okay. Writing grown woman talk was?
Liberating.
Nice. I love that. I could talk about this women's health topic again and again.
Menopause.
Menopause. Nice. Me too. I wish every woman would talk to a certified menopause specialist about getting this particular menopause care tool into their meno health toolbox.
Hormone therapy.
Nice. Even doctors need to work on their health. What is a lifestyle hacker choice that keeps your healthcare trains on the tracks?
The community of friends. We didn't even get to that part, but
nice.
It's important. Community.
Yeah, absolutely. Loneliness is a new epidemic. So, you know, get yourself girlfriends and keep them close. You are an author, an advocate, a medical advisor. You're a wife and a mom. You've got a lot of balls in the air. Is there a lifestyle choice or something that helps you kind of fuel inner peace?
I love music.
Yes.
There's something that I want to do to decompress and immediately makes me feel good. It's always music.
Love it. And for listeners, we didn't even talk about this, but Dr. Malone's book is threaded through with musical references. It's such a fun, this book is, you know, there's so much great medical information, but it's part memoir. There are a lot of stories of real women just like you in it, going through very real experiences. And Dr. Malone references musical songs throughout the book that inspire you around different points in the book. So it's a super fun read. I really encourage you to put it into your cart. Okay, so finally, your one word answer to complete the sentence, as I age, I feel?
Fearless.
Nice. You know what? I've asked 170 plus women this question, and I don't think anyone's used that word yet. So love it, love it, love it. Before we say goodbye, how can our listeners keep following you, your work, and get access to your book?
Absolutely. You can go to my website, drsharonmalone.com. The books are available wherever you buy your books. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, all of the above. And for those of you who really want to know what's going on or know where I am on my book tour, you can go to @smalonemd. That's my Instagram. And I will constantly update my tour date. So hopefully I'll be able to see you. I'll be in a city near you and get to meet you in person.
Yeah. Put that on your list, listeners, because Dr. Malone is really amazing and inspiring to hear in person. So check out that Instagram and follow the book tour. Thank you so much, Dr. Malone.
Thank you, Katie.
This wraps A Certain Age, a show for women who are aging without apology. And before I say goodbye, two quick favors. First, can you please forward this episode to a friend? Sharing the show helps it grow. You can even dump it into your girlfriend text thread. You know, the one you've got going with all the grown women in your life. Second, we would love a 5-star podcast review. Did you learn something on today's show? Do you have some easy ideas you're going to start using immediately? If so, please take 5 minutes to write a short review over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Every review helps the show grow. Special thanks to Michael Mancini, who composed and produced our theme music. See you next time. And until then, age boldly, beauties.